Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Moeller, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Moeller Program. Today we're going to be talking about the recovery of a culture of life in the midst of a culture of death. We're going to be talking about yesterday's decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. But we're also going to be talking about how the issues of life all tie together and how, for instance, this week, the conversation about partial birth abortion and the massacre at Virginia Tech and so many other issues really ought to be one large conversation. It's going to be an interesting conversation here on the program. Those who are ready to call, go ahead and give us a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of some issues in the news. I was asked as a panelist in the On Faith program at the Washington Post and Newsweek magazine to provide an article reflecting on the Virginia Tech massacre. I did so, and my article is up. Of course, you can get to it through my website, you can get to it through the Washington Post, or through Newsweek magazine. But what's really interesting is that there are now, as of just a second ago, 293 comments responding to my article. 293. That's pretty significant. And by the way, most of the others have far fewer, and I mean really far fewer. Some of them 5, 16 comments. I've right now got 300, roughly, as evidently someone's found something that they want to talk about. The most interesting of these responses, at least to me, are the ones who suggest that it's wrong to talk about this in terms of this man's evil. One of the responses came back and said, it's society that's evil. You know, how can you blame this man when we're all responsible for making guns available and all the rest? This evasion of personal moral responsibility is a direct violation of the biblical worldview. The biblical worldview does not deny systemic evil. It does not deny social evil. It does not deny that entire cultures can be collectively guilty of immoral actions. But it insists that every single one of us as individuals will give an answer for our own sin, for our own evil, for our own misbehavior. And there's no way out of our own moral responsibility. I think you'll find that conversation fascinating. You can go to Albert Moeller, that's M-O-H-L-E-R, .com. Hit the On Faith button there. You'll find in the panel on the left, or go to On Faith at the Washington Post or at Newsweek, and you'll find a robust conversation there. Speaking of interesting conversations, I was on another radio program this afternoon, and I was asked the question, is it appropriate to suggest that Mr. Cho, the man that conducted this murder, who perpetrated this crime, who killed all these people, is demon-possessed? Is it responsible to speak of him as demon-possessed? I have a reluctance about that, but also an affirmation to offer there. I think bringing in the category of the demonic is entirely appropriate. The Bible is very clear about the reality and the existence of Satan and of demons and of this realm of the demonic. These spirits that are given over to evil, that celebrate evil rather than good. And we're told that Satan himself roams to and fro, seeking whom he may devour. There's no doubt this is a pernicious activist representation of evil, according to the biblical worldview. I want to tell you, though, why I want to warn us against suggesting that this man was possessed by demons. It is because not of the word demons, but of the word possessed. And it is because only in the New Testament, from a supernatural perspective, do we understand possession. That is to say that these were persons who had been literally possessed by these demonic spirits. But we are given full authorization to see that there are those who give themselves to the demonic. What's the distinction? I want to be very, very careful that this man who perpetrated these acts is not presented as a victim of demonic influences. It doesn't just list him as one more victim, his victims now being ultimately the victims of a demonic attack. This man is responsible. In the New Testament, a couple of things to keep in mind is that those who are filled with the Spirit of Christ are invulnerable to being possessed by or filled by demons. Christians are not possessed by demons. There are others who are, but they are not presented as innocent victims, but as rather those who, for one reason or another, have in some way given themselves over to the demonic, and certainly this man is responsible. Is it right to talk of him as demon-possessed? Well, the demon part's probably right. The possessed part could be slightly dangerous, lest he be presented or understood as some kind of a victim here. Franklin Graham, speaking to this issue, the son of Billy Graham, the head of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, said, speaking of this killer, quote, "I believe there are demons that dwell in the human heart," end quote. I was asked by the media, do I agree with that? Well, of course I do. I do agree with that. But I want to be very clear that it's painfully obvious that this man gave himself to this evil. All you have to do is just see a couple of seconds of that video. All you have to do is follow the moral progression that we already know of material that's already been made available in the press, of the plays he wrote, of the documents he wrote, of the letters he wrote, of the conversations that he had with people in the dorm, including his roommates, of the practices that he had done before, stalking women and all the rest, and of the fact that his own family and others believed that he was dangerous either to himself or to others. You see a progression here, and that really is a warning to us that those who give themselves to such things can continue to cross the line. If it's not demon possession that some people are using, the possession part, in order to relieve this man of some responsibility, it's psychology or psychotherapy or even psychochemicals, psychotropic drugs. David Brooks, writing in the New York Times this morning, has a really important piece out entitled The Morality Line. He says this: over the next few days, we'll ponder the sources of Hugh Sing Hoi's rage. There'll be no shortage of analysts picking apart his hatreds, his feelings of oppression, and his dark war against the rich, Christianity, and the world at large. Some will point to the pruning of the brain cells that may be related to adolescent schizophrenia. Others may point to the possibility that an inability to process serotonin could have led to depression and hyperaggression. Or we could learn that he had been born with a brain injury that made him psychopathic. Or perhaps he was suffering from the ravages of isolation. It could be, for example, that he grew up with some form of behavioral illness that would have made it hard for him to interact with and respond appropriately to other people. Mr. Brooks goes on to say, it could be a lot of things. We could learn a lot of things about this man. But he goes on to say, for the past few decades, neuroscientists, evolutionary psychologists, and social scientists have made huge strides in understanding why people, even murderers, do the things they do. That's Mr. Brooks speaking. I actually am not quite so optimistic that they've discovered anything of fundamental importance, but I agree with him when he says that all of this has had the effect of reducing the scope of the human self. What he means by that is it has reduced the scope of human responsibility. An awful lot of what goes on right now in psychotherapy, an awful lot of what goes on right now in terms of even the dispensing of psychotropic drugs and everything else, is a way of avoiding human responsibility. There are too many people out there who say, not I did this, but, you know, the alcohol did this, or the serotonin did this, or it's not me doing this, it's my disease. I heard someone just this week say, it's not me, it's my addiction. Well, guess what? Your addiction's you. You know, this addiction doesn't have a separate address. It doesn't have a separate Social Security number. It's you. And we've got to recover moral sanity in the midst of all of this, and we've got to be very, very clear that individuals are responsible. And what we're looking at here is a man who was clearly rational. He was clearly in control. In fact, he was monomaniacally, I'm going to go back to that word again, demonically in control. It's scary to see how cold he was. It's absolutely frightening, sobering to see how calculating he was. And, you know, frankly, this shows the end of this kind of therapeutic mentality and where it goes. I mentioned this afternoon that there are four ideas that died on the Virginia Tech campus. Four ideas. The first of them is secularism. You'll notice that that just doesn't work. You know, secularism has no answer to this, either in terms of explaining why this man did this or why anyone should have hope for life beyond this. And that's why, even when the university held, for all kinds of reasons, its own memorial service, they had to bring everybody in representing every kind of spirituality, because, you know, no one is going to be able to say anything coherent just based on secularism. The second idea that died there is optimism. The idea that human beings are basically good, and the even more perverse idea that we're getting better and better all the time. You know, that flies in the face of reality. This kind of unhealthy, delusional optimism about humanity dies 1,000 deaths in every generation, and it just seems we have to learn that lesson over and over again. Euphemism died. There's just absolutely no way to call this anything other than what it is. This was not antisocial behavior. This wasn't psychopathology. This wasn't maladaptive social adjustment. This was murder. This was evil. We have to use the word for what it is. Lastly, at least in this short catalog, relativism died, because there's no way a moral relativist can respond to this with any sanity whatsoever. This isn't wrong here, but right somewhere else. This isn't a culture-dependent moral judgment. This was wrong, evil, grotesque, abhorrent. You know the old word for it, sinful. Relativism, euphemism, optimism, secularism, they have no answer to this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Yesterday's decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court was genuinely historic. And, it takes some time looking through the actual text of the decision to kind of figure out what's going on. It also takes some time to find out what all sides, all parties, are saying the decision means. Let me tell you some good news here. The right people are angry. That's a confirming sign. The right people are very, very upset about this. The New York Times hates the decision. You'll recall that yesterday, in the case Gonzalez versus Carhart, the U.S. Supreme Court, by a 5-4 margin, handed down a decision that upheld the government's right to outlaw or to ban the procedure known as the partial birth abortion procedure. And that's just great news. Six lower federal courts had thwarted the efforts of Congress and the President of the United States to outlaw this horrible and horrific procedure. Let's just remember, this should be a live birth, but at the very last moment, they kill the baby so that it's an abortion rather than a murder. It really is an atrocity. And we should be very, very glad that moral sanity and legal constitutional sanity prevailed at the Supreme Court in this 5-4 vote. We should be a little frightened that it was 5-4. But the more you look at this decision, I think the better it looks, because not only in this decision did they actually come to the right determination, the majority, but Justice Anthony Kennedy, writing for the majority, and by the way, Justice Kennedy has such a mixed record on this. Justice Kennedy is the man that really saved Roe v. Wade for the other side in the Casey decision from 1992. But he came back and used some amazing language in this, acknowledging what he called abortion as, quote, laden with the power to devalue human life. That is an incredible acknowledgement. An almost stunning admission. Even when he inserts the words "for many" in commas before this statement about it being a procedure laden with the power to devalue human life, the fact that he even put it in the decision is just huge. Its appearance is a matter of history now. That's one of the things that causes me to be somewhat hopeful about this, is that this is now a part of America's judicial history. You now have a major Supreme Court decision in which the majority of the court is saying that abortion, not just partial birth abortion, but abortion, for many people, legitimately is seen as laden with the power to devalue human life. I think also, as is so often the case, the dissenting opinions tell you even more than the majority opinion and the concurring opinions. And in this case, the dissenting opinion, written by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, really gets to the clash of worldviews better than almost anything I've seen since the Lawrence decision on homosexuality in the year 2003. It gets right to the heart of the issue. What does it say? Well, Justice Kennedy argued that one of the appropriate concerns of Congress in framing this legislation was the emotional health and mental well-being of mothers, of women who would be mothers. And the point made is that the process of partial birth abortion is so grotesque that once women, who, after all, as mothers, Justice Kennedy said, have a natural and unique bond with their own child, once they learn what happened to this child, they're likely to suffer psychic and mental pain, moral pain, and the awful regret of having had this done. That's one of the reasons, Justice Kennedy said, one of the reasons why Congress had a legitimate interest in passing this legislation. But along comes Ruth Bader Ginsburg to say that this is completely unacceptable. I want you to hear exactly what she said. She said, "This way of thinking reflects ancient notions about women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have long since been discredited." I don't think so. I don't think so. I thought about this morning when I was watching a couple of mothers deal with their babies here on our own campus. I just saw a couple of mothers They actually, obviously, had kind of accidentally run into each other on the sidewalk with their babies. And immediately what they do, they pull the babies out of the stroller. They put the babies in the arm. They show the babies to each other. The babies are cooing and holding on to each other. The babies are sticking their fingers in their mother's mouths. I was just watching this thinking, you know, here's the glory of God. Don't tell me there's not a unique bond between mother and child. I'm watching this. And I know this is a husband of a wife who so beautifully demonstrates that bond with her own children. And as the son of a mother who so beautifully demonstrated that bond with her own children. There's no doubt about this. I don't think anyone with common sense doubts that. And it's just incredible that a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court would actually feel the need to refute that. And that's essentially what Ruth Bader Ginsburg did. Let me just read you her words again. This way of thinking reflects ancient notions about women's place in the family and under the Constitution, ideas that have long since been discredited. Now, last night, in the early hours of the morning, I was looking at that again. I was scratching my head trying to figure out, what is she talking about there? I mean, could it be that she's saying what it looks like she's saying? And then I started looking at her dissent. I started putting in the context of other things she's written and looking at it. And I had this chilling realization that I do get her point now. She believes that mothers aren't a category here. Only women. Because she also complains in the in her dissent that Justice Kennedy uses words like unborn child and baby. You see, I don't think she's just dissenting from Justice Kennedy's assertion that there's a unique emotional bond between a mother and a child. I think she's dissenting from the category of mother being constitutionally important in the first place. It took me a while looking at the decision to realize I think that's what she's saying. Because she goes on again to say we shouldn't use words like baby and unborn child, but I guess accidental product of conception, you know, biomass unwanted by its host. You know, you can just try to find all these euphemisms, but the bottom line is every one of us knows we're talking about mother and baby, mother and child. And that moral knowledge is something that can't long be suppressed. You know, earlier this week we were talking about the dinner party test. That's a major article I posted at my website this week. It, to me, is another one of those reminders of what Jay Budachevsky at the University of Texas calls the revenge of conscience. You can try to hold things down. You can try to suppress the conscience, but it comes raging back at you. I think that's what happened on the Virginia Tech campus. I think an awful lot of people, I mean, I know some of the people who are members of that faculty, and I know some of their writings. I know that that faculty's got its own collection of the politically correct and the postmodern and all the rest. There are moral relativists, or at least advocates of moral relativism teaching on that campus. But you know what? Conscience came back with a vengeance. As on that campus, those tears and that grief demonstrated moral revulsion at the murderous rampage that took place there. By that same token, you know, you start looking at this and you realize that the revenge of conscience comes back in this dinner party test. You know, you can say there's nothing wrong with abortion. You can say it's not a great moral issue. It's just a woman's constitutional right to her own personal autonomy and to control her body and all the rest. But as the article makes very clear that I was citing from the Independent in Great Britain, you know, in Great Britain, they're running out of abortionists. They're running out of doctors to perform abortions. They're calling this a national crisis. And why? Well, some of their own people are saying it's the dinner party test. No one wants to say at the dinner party, I'm an abortionist. Why? Because there again, the revenge of conscience. The ugliness, the grotesque nature, the abhorrence of the procedure is just right there, unavoidable for all to see. Even a lot of liberal people who say they're for a woman's right to choose wouldn't want their son to show up at the next Christmas affair saying, oh yeah, I just finished my residency in abortion. I'm going to become an abortionist. You know, conscience does come back with a vengeance. Folks, let me ask you a question. Can you make a connection between abortion and what happened on the Virginia Tech campus? Can you make a connection between a society's embrace of murder in the womb and murder that takes place in a classroom? That's going to be an interesting experiment for us. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Big question, big conversation. We'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday is a landmark decision. And again, I think that's becoming more and more clear when you look at the response from both sides of this controversy. Both sides seem to get it, and that in itself is pretty much a significant issue. I mentioned yesterday that Eleanor Smeal of the Feminist Majority Foundation said that this was a case that threatened, you know, women's right to an abortion in a fundamental way. We also have other reports, including from editorial pages like at the New York Times, that saying basically that this is an atrocity. The court made a huge mistake. And, of course, some of the implications of these editorial pages would be that this is a decision that someday will cause embarrassment to the court. I think what should cause embarrassment is Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. The Supreme Court has been embarrassed in the past by its decisions, the most glaring example being the Dred Scott case that declared African-American human beings to be only three-fifths human and upholding slavery. So you look back at that, the Supreme Court, along with other institutions in this country, has had some big issues to answer for, but I think none will be bigger in the end of the day than Roe v. Wade. Now, there may be some who want to ask questions about this decision and what it means. I want to ask you, are you encouraged by this? Is this something that that you think is a major victory for the pro-life cause? You know, how do you see this? What are your feelings? And more than that, what is your thinking about what this means in terms of the fight to recover full human dignity? And can you make a link? Can you describe and argue for a link between the culture of death, as represented by abortion in the womb, and the culture of death, as represented by the killings on the Virginia Tech campus? I want us to think carefully, not crudely and simplistically, but can we make that case? The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'd love to have you join the conversation, because this is the place for intelligent Christian conversation, where day by day we gather to talk about the issues and try to figure out how should we as Christians be thinking about these things, and in a way of diagnosing the conflict of worldviews, how should we as Christians be thinking in a way that is unique, that is in ways that would not be shared by people who do not start with the fundamental truths of Christianity as the starting point for worldview thinking. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have callers on the line. We'll get to those calls in just a moment. I do want to suggest that one of the learning experiences, and to parents especially, when you've got kids and you're talking about some of these things, and please tell me you're talking about these things. Please tell me with your children you're talking about why the Supreme Court case was necessary. You're explaining to them what's at stake and why we have to recover human dignity. One of the things you might help them to do is to understand how to interpret the media coverage on these issues and how to interpret, you know, the cultural conversation going on about this very issue. All right, Jeff's calling from Bristol, Virginia. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, Dr. Mohler. Thanks for getting me on. To answer your first question, I definitely think that there's a link between abortion and the culture of death, and I think a lot of that just comes from the evolutionary ethic, that there is no dignity to humans and there is no understanding of what it means to be human and be made in God's creation in His image.
Yes. And let me just say, let me interrupt you there to say that's a strong argument. I think you're headed in exactly the right direction. It gets back to how we define human dignity. And from a secular viewpoint, from, say, an evolutionary viewpoint, we're nothing but especially highly developed protoplasm. And that's not the foundation of a worldview that can sustain the dignity of life. But, Jeff, you want to say something else? Go right ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to ask the question, speaking more specifically to legislation about abortion. I'm definitely glad that this passed in the Supreme Court, and I definitely am against abortion. But as a husband, I am concerned about my wife, of course, and if she were to have a complication in pregnancy to where if she were to deliver the baby, would it be detrimental to her life? And I'm just wondering how, as Christians, should we think about that, and should we be more concerned that when we are urging to pass legislation and restrictions on abortion, that there be some kind of sensible language in there to allow, in very rare extreme cases, an abortion if the mother's life is in danger.
Well, you know, Jeff, as we go into the break, you know this bill that was upheld does have that provision. You knew that, right?
I didn't. All I heard from the newspapers is that it didn't.
Okay, what they're saying is, and that's, boy, you raised a great issue. We come back, we'll talk about it. What they're saying is there's no provision for health. That's because they're not satisfied with a provision for life. And I'll talk about why that distinction is important when we come back. Appreciate Jeff's call. Your call could be next. The phone number 877-893-8255. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. We're talking about yesterday's decision handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court in the case Gonzalez versus Carhart. It's a big victory for the culture of life, bigger than I think I even recognized yesterday when I just saw the summary of the decision. Reading the decision, I think, leads me to believe it's even more important. The question we're asking right now is not only what does this mean, some will want to talk about that, but also can we draw a line between this and the culture of death in the womb and the culture of death in the classroom? Can we draw a line between this culture's embrace of abortion and so many other evils, and the evils that work their way out in such things as the Virginia Tech massacre? There could be real simplistic arguments made there. That's not what we're going after. We're going after arguments that get down to foundational issues. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let me start to make the case for why I believe there is such a tie. I don't think you can draw a direct line. I don't think you can say, look, Roe v. Wade 1973 leads directly to Virginia Tech in 2007. That's simplistic, and it ignores the fact that we are complex moral beings living in a complex moral situation. Nothing is that easy. But here's the case I would make. What we see in the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973 is not just the cause of something, it's the result of something. It's the result already in 1973 of a basic decision to decouple morality from the issues of human existence and human dignity. It's the effort to say we can kill babies in the womb, and we can call it something other than what it is, and we can transform it into what we claim is a woman's right to choose, and yet we can still honor human dignity. Obviously, that doesn't work. And we dishonor human dignity in so many other ways. We reduce our understanding of human moral responsibility. We start turning everything into therapy rather than in matters of right and wrong, because we're afraid in this postmodern age of being accused of judgmentalism. And so we find everything we can to find an environmental cause, a medical, a pharmacological cause, rather than a moral cause for the evil that we do and that we see done. And then I also want to make the case that if you embrace a worldview that says that humanity, human beings in particular, are just basically accidents of an evolutionary and social biological process, then you have no real ground, no real foundation for saying why killing is wrong. You can say it's inconvenient, messy, socially awkward, but in the bottom line, you can't say that it's wrong for any fundamental transcendent reason. Now, I mentioned earlier in the program that the whole idea of secularism really kind of crashed on the Virginia Tech campus. And I would argue that the whole idea of secularism as an ism crashed in Justice Kennedy's decision in the case Gonzalez versus Carhart. You know, why did it crash in that decision? Because the decision acknowledges the basic moral question. And that may be the most important achievement of that decision, is to acknowledge the basic moral question. If you don't know what took place in that decision, I just want to read to you again a specific section from Justice Kennedy's majority opinion. This is what he said. In a decision so fraught with emotional consequence, some doctors may prefer not to disclose precise details of the means that will be used, confining themselves to the required statement of risk the procedure entails. From one standpoint, this ought not to be surprising. Any number of patients facing imminent surgical procedures would prefer not to hear all the details, lest the usual anxiety preceding invasive medical procedures become the more intense. This is likely the case with abortion procedures here in issue. It is, however, precisely this lack of information concerning the way in which the fetus will be killed that is of legitimate concern to the state. Okay, we already have a little revolution in language here. It's not child, it's not baby, it's still fetus in this paragraph, but the verb is killed. Not terminated, not aborted, but killed. Back to the text. The state, that is the government, has an interest in ensuring so grave a choice is well informed. It is self-evident that a mother who comes to regret her choice to abort must struggle with grief more anguished and sorrow more profound when she learns only after the event what she once did not know. Listen to this. This is language out of the decision. That she allowed a doctor to pierce the skull and vacuum the fast-developing brain of her unborn child, a child assuming the human form. That, ladies and gentlemen, is language you can't euphemize. You can't tidy that up and make it into a marketing slogan. The ugliness of that language is a more honest admission of the ugliness of abortion than we have seen in a very, very long time. Justice Kennedy acknowledged that for many, even the most common form of abortion is, and I quote, a procedure itself laden with the power to devalue human life. And he went on and said, beyond that, the partial birth abortion procedure, and again I'm quoting his language, implicates additional ethical and moral concerns that justify a special prohibition. On the left, you hear people making a one-to-one connection, very quickly jumping from the massacre at Virginia Tech to issues about gun control. We could debate that. That's not our topic today. It would be easy for some of us on the conservative pro-life side to come out and say, well, what do you expect? This is the inevitable result of Roe v. Wade or Lawrence v. Texas or whatever else. Simplistic arguments really don't help. But there is an argument here that's really important. And that's the argument that once you decouple morality from any kind of transcendent authority, once you try to get rid of a supernatural morality and just live by a merely natural morality, and that natural morality not based on anything even like natural law, but rather just on a secular understanding, and by secular meaning beginning with the assumption that there is no God. And that's the crucial distinction here between the secular and the natural or supernatural understanding of morality. When you start with that secular perspective, you've got nowhere to go to define and explain why life is precious and why it should be protected. You have nowhere to go in suggesting why life should be prized and hope should be our experience in the aftermath of something like this. We are incredibly resilient creatures. So many times in recent days I've thought of that great quote from T.S. Eliot I've used on this program so many times, that human beings can stand only so much reality. The intensity of our response to the massacre at Virginia Tech has taken over the airwaves. It's been constant, and it will be for some time to come. Facing these issues, whether it be partial birth abortion in the Carhartt decision or mass murder in the Virginia Tech massacre, we have faced reality. Justice Kennedy faced reality. I think that comes out in this language. I think we're all facing reality when we look at the images from Virginia Tech. But here's a warning to us all. In fairly short order, we won't be talking about these things every day. I wonder if we'll still feel the moral reality. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You can get in the flow of discussion and go right over something you said you're going to talk about. That's what I did a little bit earlier when Jeff called, and I said I need to get back to the issue about an exception for the life of the mother or the health of the mother, and I said that has historic and complicated language. The Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act of 2002 does include language that exempts from the ban procedures that are necessary to save the life of a mother. In other words, if a physician certifies that in order to save the mother, this must be done, the procedure can be done. But there is no provision that simply says health, and I want to tell you why. And it's because in the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973, the issue of health was put in, and it was expanded to physical and emotional health. And what that did was open the door entirely. Because if health is described in such a way that includes emotional state, then almost anyone at any time can say this woman needs it in order to feel better. You know, she has a psychic or emotional need for this abortion. So that's the reason it's taken out. And also, there is good evidence to believe that there is no legitimate health interest that would require this procedure over against some other procedure that could be done. Jeff, you ask a good question. And by the way, there's a bigger moral question even behind the legal question there, and that would be, if a mother's life is genuinely threatened by her baby, is it all right for her to have an abortion or to have a life-saving procedure that could cause the death of the child? And you notice I shifted there from one to the other, from A to B, one to two. It still would not be right to have an abortion. In other words, it would still not be right to have a procedure, the goal of which is simply the death of the child. It would be morally acceptable for the woman to have a surgical procedure necessary to save her life if it meant the death of the baby. I hope that makes sense to you. In other words, the death of the infant is to be seen as a tragedy that is necessitated by the greater good of saving the mother's life. It means that there is no direct ambition to kill the child. This isn't an effort to get rid of the child, to terminate the child's life. Rather, it's the unavoidable and tragic byproduct of an action to save the mother's life. And for that reason, and by the way, the moral imperative behind that is not to say that the mother's life is necessarily more important than the baby's life. She's no more made in the image of God than is her unborn child. It is to say that the need for the mother, the social function of the mother, the responsibilities of the mother, both in terms of her ability to have future children and to care for the children that she presumably may already have, is a legitimate interest. There again, you know, we as human beings find ourselves sometimes in difficult positions facing awful and excruciating moral questions. We better figure out ahead of time what our basic principles and convictions are, because it's very difficult to do that while in the line of fire. Folks, thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.